Hi, listeners. If you love Undisclosed, I have two small favors to ask you. First of all, please support our sponsors because they support us. Check out their great products and services using the unique Undisclosed codes and URLs that we provide every week so that we can keep coming back to you week after week. And the second favor I'd like to ask you is this. I am so excited to announce that Undisclosed has finally launched a Patreon page. Now, if you've ever wondered how you can support our work, this is finally one way you can do so. You can become a patron of Undisclosed for as little as $5 a month. All you got to do is go to patreon.com/undisclosedpod and sign up there. Check out our Patreon page at patreon.com/undisclosedpod.
During my first trip to Camden County Sheriff's Deputy Dale Bundy agreed to talk to me about the Swain case and his investigation into Dennis Perry. He knew that I was working with the Georgia Innocence Project to investigate Dennis's case as a possible wrongful conviction, and he thought our interest in Dennis Perry was misplaced. But he respected our goals and was willing to share with me what he knew.
Obviously, we're interested in the case and that we have questions about it. I'm just curious, from your perspective, can you see why we're curious about the case or why we think we have questions about it?
I can't.
Okay. Yeah, no, that's I'm wondering, like, to you, is it, like, mystifying
that we're
here at all?
Your jobs are to be the devil's advocates, you know, to blow apart what we did. And if you can do it and prove it, more power to you, ladies and gentlemen. I admire you for what you do. That's why I bared my soul. I get off at 5 o'clock, it's 20 after, and I'm still sitting here with you.
You need to get home. Thank you so much. I appreciate it. And it does mean a lot to me to talk to us. A lot of times, investigators won't talk, and you're like, what are you trying to hide?
I have nothing to hide. I have absolutely nothing to hide.
I believed him. I thought he was wrong about the case, but it just seemed like he wouldn't have been that willing to share what he knew if he hadn't thought his case against Dennis was solid. Sure, he could guess that we were going to find things in the case to nitpick at, as he put it, but he didn't act like someone who had any fear of the truth coming out. Then, one morning, a couple days later, I got an email. I was still in Woodbine at the time, with the Georgia Innocence Project. Ann Claire Gilbert, Christina Cribbs, and I had been sitting out on the porch making plans for the day when the email came in.
You can read the email from Bundy.
Susan, as expected, I thought of what I wanted to ask you not long after we parted ways on Friday. There has been much hearsay after the fact, musing opinions ad nauseum about the case against Dennis Perry. There have been claims made about pictures, photo lineups, etc., that have no basis in fact. My question on all this information is simply this. Why wasn't any of this part of the defense case in the trial? Dennis had a well-known, competent attorney from Jacksonville, but none of these allegations against Jane Beaver, the clearing of the suspect by payroll records, etc., were part of the defense case. I wish you well in your endeavors and tried to be as truthful and accurate as I could. I must say, though, I feel as though I was originally misled as to your role and feel I was somewhat taken advantage of by you to further your cause. I told you the truth to the best of my recollection. You will find the truth harder to obtain as your search continues.
I don't understand why he didn't explain why he thinks I took advantage of him, though.
Maybe he Googled you.
But I told him,
well,
like,
it was very
you.
Clear. It was very clear.
But why does he think... I'm really confused.
I don't think it has anything to do with you. It has to do with the facts of the investigation. Like, I think... There's no way he can not come across looking badly if the facts are accurately portrayed. So, not badly as a person, but just like a shoddy investigation. I mean, this man is sentenced to 2 life sentences based on eyewitness identifications secured 13 years after the fact, after they were given single picture show-ups. I mean, it's ludicrous.
Huh.
But I wouldn't take that. He probably
I'm just
is just realizing the implications of talking to you.
You will find the truth harder to obtain as your search continues.
The truth? Doesn't he think we already know the truth? That Dennis Perry did it? What does that even
you will
mean?
Find
that suggests to me that people are not going to talk.
Yeah.
But I mean, what does that mean? If
they're talking
But if he thinks Dennis Perry committed the crime, what truth is there to find? We already know it, according to him.
Right.
You will find the truth harder to obtain as your search continues.
I think about that phrase a lot. I don't know what Bundy meant by it, and if he was making a prediction, he wasn't wrong. In some ways, what he'd written seemed kind of discouraging. In this case, the truth had already been hard enough to obtain, and anything that made it harder just seemed unfair. But I came to realize what Bundy had written wasn't discouraging at all. It was the opposite. Because when someone tells you that the truth is going to become harder to obtain, what it means is that there's still a truth out there that you don't know about yet. You just have to find it. Welcome to episode 11 of Undisclosed, The State vs. Dennis Perry. I'm Susan Simpson, an attorney in Washington, D.C., and I blog at The View from LL2. And this episode will be a bit different from usual. Colin and Robbie will be back next week, but for this week, it'll just be me. Because this episode is a story about a visit I made to Camden County and what I found there. One reason the truth has become harder to obtain in this case has nothing to do with Dale Bundy or anyone in the Camden County Sheriff's Office. Just due to the passage of time, though, many witnesses are no longer with us, and many of the people who might have had answers to some of the questions I have are no longer around for me to ask. The women who were at Rising Daughter on the night the Swains were killed were mostly in their 50s and 60s, and in the years since then, many have passed away. But in 1998, when Dale Bundy reopened his investigation, all but one of the witnesses were still alive, and yet only a handful of them were ever interviewed.
And which ones, so you'd think it was Vanzola and Cora were the two that you talked to, or were able to talk to? And not possibly, Vandora was still alive. I think she's still alive.
Vanzola Williams was still alive. Cora was still alive. She wasn't in a nursing home. I don't remember who else I talked to without digging into it.
That part of the reopened investigation bothered me a lot. When you have 9 witnesses to a murder, how come there were only 2 who ever really talked to? Bundy didn't rule out the possibility that he'd interviewed other witnesses, but he didn't recall doing so either. That meant that there were 8 women in all who'd been there that night, still alive. But Bundy was only interested in hearing from Cora and Vanzola. And Dennis Perry's defense team wasn't much different in its approach to the case. In 2001, a defense investigator went out and interviewed Cora Fisher at her nursing home and tried to interview Vanzola Williams, but she'd refused to talk to them. The only other church lady the defense talked to was Vandora Baker, who they'd asked for an interview and she'd agreed. But that left 6 other witnesses who the defense never tried to talk to at all. One of those 6, Letty Frazier, actually did testify at Dennis Perry's trial, but for the rest of the church ladies, the defense just never heard from them at all, full stop. Today, in 2018, of the 9 women who were in the church that night when Harold and Thelma were killed, I knew of only 2 that were still alive, Vandora Baker and Gwen Owens. Both had been in their 30s at the time of the murders, and both still lived in Waverly today. And since there were so few witnesses left in this case, I was really hoping that both of them would speak to me about it, especially Gwen Owens, with whom no interview had been recorded in the past 33 years. And so, during trips to Camden County, GIP intern Ed Kostikian and I went out to find them.
Okay, look, almost everybody knows that Blue Apron delivers farm-fresh ingredients and step-by-step recipes to your door. We all know what Blue Apron does, right? Their mission is to make incredible home cooking accessible to everybody. But here's the thing. I want to add a dimension about Blue Apron that I haven't talked about before. The truth is that I was discussing this with my husband the other day that, you know, I realize much of our lives we have spent eating badly because we don't know how to proportion the kinds of things that should be on our plate, right? Like we end up having massive amounts of white carby stuff and then we add things to flavor it. Here's a little chicken, here's a little veggies, but really the mainstay is stuff that's really not good for you in any way. And for me, Blue Apron helped solve this issue because I don't naturally know how to cook in a way that is healthier. I mean, it's terrible to say I've been cooking for my family for many, many years now. I mean, like almost 25 years, but I need to learn to cook better. And Blue Apron has helped me learn to do that, okay? They deliver fresh, seasonally inspired ingredients. They are healthy ingredients. These are healthy meals. These are good meals, okay? They're chef-designed recipes. They taste delicious. You feel like, did I make this or was it from a restaurant? And 20 minutes. It takes like 20, 30 minutes to get an entire dinner ready for your whole family, all right? I have finally been able to get out of my cooking rut and experience the joy of new recipes, healthier recipes, more flavorful recipes with Blue Apron. I'm excited about trying out some of their new fall recipes in the next couple of weeks, including seared steaks and homemade steak sauce with mashed potatoes and sauteed carrots, and the stir-fried sweet chili chicken with broccoli and rice, and the one dinner I can't wait to make and eat is the seared beef dumplings, because I love dumplings, with sesame garlic bok choy salad. I can promise you, in my life, I never would have made sesame garlic bok choy salad in my own home. So thank you, Blue Apron, for getting me out of my rut. Now, check out this week's menu. Get your first three meals for free at blueapron.com/undisclosed. Don't forget to use a URL that has undisclosed in it because you support our sponsors. They support us. Once again, it's blueapron.com/undisclosed and get your first three meals absolutely free. Blue Apron, a better way to cook.
At 31 years old, Miss Vandora Baker had been the youngest of the women there that night at Rising Daughter. And she'd been one of the witnesses who'd gotten a glimpse of the white man in the vestibule who'd shot and killed Harold and Thelma. Though it hadn't been a very good glimpse, she said. She'd seen just a flash as she'd looked back towards the swinging double doors. And the detail that had stood out to her most strongly was his hair, shoulder length and blonde. And he was a small man, she'd seen enough to know that. Slender in build, she said, about 5'6 to 5'8. But then the shooting had begun, and she just started running and hadn't looked back. When Ed and I showed up at her doorstep, she agreed to talk to us. And we talked there in front of her house for about an hour. For the most part, she told us the same story she'd given at least four times before. Even now, after 33 years, none of the details of Vandora's story have really changed. Vandora hadn't wanted us to record the interview, but as we left her house, Ed Kostikian and I talked about how the interview had gone.
She seemed anxious.
Yeah, yeah. That's a better way of putting it. She wasn't like, she wasn't excited to talk to us, but she would do it.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
She was definitely not excited to talk to us. But, poor woman. They should have all had some kind of therapy. My
oh,
God.
Absolutely.
So they just never talked about it. They all just went back and just tried to forget it. Except for Cora Fisher.
Yeah, it's always shocking to me that, like, no one followed up with them or they didn't, like, search it out on their own. But I guess
she knew almost nothing about the case.
Yeah.
I was really struck by that fact. She didn't really. And she was reading it in the paper, so it's not that she, like, didn't want to know. She was seeking out some information.
Vandora Baker had known very little about the case beyond what she'd witnessed for herself that night at Rising Daughter. And it's not because she hadn't wanted to know. She didn't like remembering the murders, but she'd made an effort to keep up with what was reported on the case in the media. She'd wanted to know about what had happened to the Swains and to her and the other women, but she'd never been told much by investigators, and she and the other women from the church just never really talked about it with one another. She'd only found out about someone being arrested in the murders by reading it in the paper. She'd never heard anything about why it was that Dennis Perry had supposedly killed the Swains, though she'd heard a rumor once that Harold Swain had walked up on someone doing something they shouldn't have, and thought maybe it could be that. Mendora had been glad, though, when someone had been arrested. She'd felt relief, knowing they finally got the guy. But she said she never heard why it was they thought Dennis Perry was the guy. She'd simply taken their word for it. She'd had no reason to doubt it. The other surviving witness to the murders at Rising Daughter was Gwen Owens. Gwen's daughter, Leslie, was also technically a witness, as she'd been there in the church that night with her mom. But Leslie had been so young at the time that she hadn't really known what was going on. But Gwen Owens had. She'd gotten one of the best looks of the shooter, and she'd assisted in making two composites of the man, one she prepared by herself, and one that she and three other ladies from the church had made together. From the transcripts we have of Gwen Owens' recorded interview back in March of 85, she seemed to be exactly the kind of witness that you'd want to hear from. Detailed and careful in her words, and also, she'd been able to get a glimpse of Harold and the man as they'd grappled with one another in the vestibule, something that only Margie Moore had also seen. When I brought up Gwen Owens with Dale Bundy, though, he told me not to get my hopes up about talking to her.
And there's two more that actually saw him, sort of. Gwen Owens is one of them.
Gwen Owens isn't going to say anything to anybody. Her really? Husband told her to stay out of this.
According to Bundy, Gwen Owens and her daughter had given investigators false descriptions of the man they'd seen in the church that night. Not because it was malicious, but just because she was just too afraid of what would happen to her and her daughter if she'd given an accurate description of the killer.
I know she made the statement, or her daughter, it may have been her daughter that made the statement. My daddy told me to say that the man had red hair and flames coming out of his eyes, but, you know, Gwendolyn kind of hung on that too. And I think it was more to protect their daughter than it was her, because her daughter was in that church.
Yeah.
Red hair and flames shooting out of his eyes, like some kind of demon. I still don't know where exactly Bundy got this from, or the flames part anyway. I've never seen it in any report. In 1985, Leslie, Gwen's daughter, did tell investigators that the man had red hair and a red mustache, which was not something that any other witness had reported. And yeah, it's kind of a weird detail, but she was also like 6 years old, which I feel is a fact that should be taken into account here before deciding that it was some attempt to be intentionally misleading. And Leslie's mother, Gwen, well, her descriptions of the man had been very much in line with what other witnesses had said. Gwen said the man had blonde hair, shoulder length, parted in the middle. He was slender and maybe 5'6 to 5'8 in height. There were no red hair, no flames, no devil coming in through the vestibule doors. Still, Bundy had come to the conclusion that the Owens' descriptions of the man had been intentionally fabricated.
So I wrote Gwen Owens off real quick. I mean, she was a non-cooperative witness. Again, she was one of these people that was afraid to say anything because of Dennis's ties locally.
At that point, when I was talking to Bundy, I'd seen nothing in the file yet about Gwen Owens being uncooperative. In fact, everything I'd seen had given me the opposite impression.
She did cooperate initially, at least, I guess the day after.
If you look in the old notes on this case, you'll find a page where somebody wrote that Gwendolyn Owens' husband had told her to tell them that the man had red hair and flames coming out of it, or something, had bright red hair and didn't fit the description at all. So that was her way of getting out of it.
Later on, we did receive some additional files in the Swain case, and in those records, there was a memo from Vicki Moore, the investigator for the Camden County DA's office. It was written in September of 1999, and it was an update for the prosecutor on various matters related to the ongoing Dennis Perry investigation. It said,
I just spoke to Dale Bundy about having Gwendolyn and Leslie Owens interviewed. Dale advised that he did interview Gwendolyn last year, and she won't cooperate. She said that the composite picture doesn't look like the man she saw that night. Then she says that she didn't get a good look at the man. Ron Rose attempted to interview Leslie Owens, the girl, and she won't talk. It would help if they document this stuff. 14 years ago, when Gwendolyn and Leslie were interviewed, they were interviewed together. Leslie's description was that the man had red bushy hair, and then she says something to the effect of, that's what daddy. Now, Dale believes that her daddy told her to say this because the killer was someone local and they were trying to protect her. Dale said that he would re-interview if you want, but he knows that they won't cooperate.
So, Dale Bundy had interviewed Gwen Owens. There's no other record at all in the files about this interview, nor are there any notes in the GBI file about Agent Ron Rose's attempt to interview Gwen's daughter, but apparently it did happen at some point.
You know, the last time I talked to her, I said, Gwendolyn, I know you know more than you're telling me, but I appreciate the fact you want to stay out of it. Have a nice day.
That could explain why she's not returned my calls.
She's not going to return anybody's calls on anything that has to do with this case. I'd be surprised if she did. I don't know, maybe age has mellowed her out a bit.
Support for Undisclosed comes from our friends at Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. They understand that home plays a big role in your life and family. That's why they created Rocket Mortgage. Rocket Mortgage gives you the confidence you need when it comes to buying a home or refinancing your existing home loan. It's simple, allowing you to fully understand all the details and be confident you're getting the right mortgage for you. Whether you're looking to buy your first home or your 10th, with Rocket Mortgage you get a transparent online process that gives you the confidence to make an informed decision. It's convenient. Our trusted partners allow you to share your financial information with Rocket Mortgage at the touch of a button. And in addition to getting a real mortgage approval in minutes, you can even adjust the rate and length of your loan in real time to make sure you're getting the right solution for you. Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Apply simply, understand fully, mortgage confidently. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/undisclosed. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states, NMLSconsumerAccess.org number 3030.
I can't say I hadn't been warned by Bundy, but I was going to try to talk to Gwen and Leslie anyway. And besides, the idea that Gwen Owens somehow wouldn't cooperate with investigators was just hard to square with what I'd seen in the files. And the Swain's niece, Cynthia Clayton, had told me that the story wasn't anywhere near as dramatic as Dale Bundy had made it out to be. Yes, at some point over the years, Gwen Owens had become frustrated with the investigation. But Cynthia thought that this had happened only years later, as the investigation wore on.
It's just always reliving it. And I think for her, it's like, I just, you know, it's done and I just want to be out of it. I think that has been the stance that she has taken.
So one day earlier this year, Ed Kosticki and I stopped by a house where I thought maybe Leslie Owens lived now. The woman who came to the door was older than Leslie would have been. And when I asked for Leslie and explained why I wanted to talk to her, the woman gruffly told us that her daughter wasn't home and wouldn't be home anytime soon. And then closed the door on us. The woman, I realized, must have been Gwen Owens, but we'd apparently lost our chance to talk to her. So Ed and I were heading back to the car, and I began recording an update on how the interview had gone.
Oh, that's that. We tried. I did! I do!
The woman that I thought must be Gwen Owens had called out to us from the house, wanting to know if I had a business card that I could give her. So I turned around and headed back to the house again. She took the card and was about to send me off again, but this time she only closed the screen door on me, so I could still talk to her through the screen door. And figuring that I might not get another chance again, I decided to try and talk to her about the case.
Are you a Gwen Owens?
Yes, I am.
I'd like to speak to you if you wouldn't mind. So what I'm doing is I'm a reporter, and I'm looking into the Swain case.
Okay.
Can I ask you one question, though? I was talking to Dale Bundy, and he told me that he thought that y'all had always known who the killer was and were too afraid to tell them back then. Okay, that's all I wanted to know. Thank you, ma'am.
Gwen Owens' answer had been immediate and forceful. That's a lie. But she made it clear that she wasn't interested in talking to us any further. And so, once again, we headed back to the car. And once again, just before we got back to where I'd parked, a voice from the house called out to us.
What was the problem?
Nobody believed us, Gwen Owens had said. But I hadn't heard what she said after that, so for the third time, I turned around and went back to the house.
What didn't they believe? I've read the reports. She was 8 years old?
She was little.
And I've read your statements, and to me it seemed like you were trying to be as helpful as you could, so I didn't know.
I was prepared to be sent off once again, for Gwen Owens to say once more that this was old and finished business and she wasn't going to talk about it, but this time she kept talking.
Did someone tell your daughter to lie?
Why would they do that? She's a child. That's a damn lie.
So, Bundy,
I'm getting angry now.
I'm sorry. I talked to Bundy for a while. What he told me
is that... Who is it, a detective?
Dale Bundy.
Well, I don't believe a thing he said.
What he told me was that someone told your daughter to...
That's a lie. And how would he know that?
I don't know. That's why I...
That's a darn lie.
Can I...
I'm a Christian, so please don't make me curse anymore.
Gwen Owens was clearly irritated by my questions, but she was also curious now, and so finally, she came out. And I talked to Gwen Owens the same way I seemed to end up talking to a lot of witnesses in Camden County, while standing out in their front porch in 1,000% humidity, being absolutely eaten alive by a million bugs. It was worth it, though, because it turns out that Gwen Owens had a lot to say. I think it's fair to say that Gwen Owens had something of a no-nonsense personality. But as we talked, she'd quickly relaxed, and she was friendly and funny and not at all like the woman I expected to meet, based on how Dale Bundy had described her. She told me the story of what she'd seen that night in the church and how traumatic it had all been. We were spared, she said, but the nightmare still came for a long time. And like with Vandora Baker, there was so much about the case that Gwen Owens had never known, and that no one had ever been willing to tell her. She'd been listed as a witness for the state, so even though she'd never been called to the stand, it had meant that she'd been sequestered during the trial, so she hadn't seen any of it. She didn't know why she hadn't been called as a witness, but she'd guessed it was because she'd been deemed to be one of the less credible witnesses. That's what she had meant when she'd called out to me the third time as I was leaving, to say that they hadn't been believed. And it wasn't just herself that she thought hadn't been believed. Gwen thought that all the contradicting descriptions of the shooter that the woman had given had caused the investigators not to believe them. And worse yet, that it had caused investigators to not be able to solve the case. I thought what I had said was pretty accurate, Gwen Owens told me. But when other people were interviewed, they thought what they had said was accurate too. All I can say is there were several of us in the church, and evidently, none of us got it right. Gwen Owens described how she'd always felt this deep sense of disappointment about it, about how she and other women couldn't agree on what the man had looked like, about how their descriptions of the shooter had all been different. And Gwen's use of the word disappointment had seemed striking to me, not something I had expected. I asked her, "Did you feel like you'd failed?" "I think we felt like that for a lot of years," she said. "And then, as years went by, we just kind of got over it. And anytime we got over it, it was right back." And then she gave Ed and I kind of a sharp look before adding, "And now it's back again." After the interview, both Ed and I had been struck by the sense of failure that Gwen Owens had carried with her for all those years.
I was kind of, it was really sad to hear her talk about how, like, they felt that, they were disappointed that they couldn't come up with a guy. And no one ever told them that, like, that's absolutely normal.
The whole time. Like, that's actually pretty disrespectful. Like, that Bundy would say that.
Totally disrespectful.
Dale Bundy was wrong. Gwen Owens had wanted to help very badly. And it became clear to me that the reason Bundy had thought Gwen Owens was uncooperative had nothing to do with Gwen Owens not being willing to help, and everything to do with what Gwen Owens had to say not being helpful to Bundy's case. Because Bundy's case was based in large part on a composite image, one that Gwen Owens and Margie Moore and Cora Fisher and Mazzola Williams had all made together in March of 85. And that composite image had been used to convict Dennis Perry, based on his resemblance to the man depicted there. But when I showed the composite to Gwen Owens and asked her if this looked like the man she'd seen that night at Rising Daughter, she'd studied it for a moment and then said, "No, it doesn't." And that's probably why Dale Bundy, during his investigation, had never shown Gwen Owens a photo of his lead suspect, Dennis Perry. In fact, Gwen Owens had never seen Dennis Perry at all. "We never got a chance to see that particular man that they put on trial," she told us. But she was interested in seeing what he looked like, and she asked me to show her a photo, which I had not been planning on doing and really kind of didn't want to do. Because the absolute last thing I wanted to do was to reenact what Jane Beaver had done all those years ago, going to the church ladies' houses and showing them a single photo of Dennis Perry. But Gwen Owens was insistent, and I figured that if I didn't show her one, she'd just go look it up online as soon as I left. So I pulled up the only photo that I had access to at the time, from an email I'd looked at earlier that GIP had sent out, showing Dennis Perry in prison at a graduation ceremony, receiving his GED. She looked at the photo for a long moment, studying it, and then she just said, "He looks kind of tall." "Well, kind of tall, I guess," I told her. "He's 5'10". And she was surprised. The man in the vestibule had seemed much smaller to her, she said. "To tell you the truth," she told us, "the fellow we'd seen with the glasses looked kind of nerdy." We were talking about how Cora Fisher and Vanzola Williams had identified that man as the one they'd seen in Rising Daughter. When Gwen Owens gave us something of a warning, "Not everything we'd heard from the witnesses of Rising Daughter was necessarily true," she said. "Like I told you, some of the ladies might exaggerate." "Not all of the ladies," Gwen Owens said, "but some of them. And this had been a problem. For one thing," Gwen Owens said, "a bunch of lies had gotten out about what went on during this process. Some of the people that were there had exaggerated and made things up." I asked Gwen Owens about what she meant, about who she meant, but she wouldn't give names. That would have been rude and accusatory, and she wasn't going to go there. Not for some strangers that had shown up on her doorstep. "I'll just tell you," she repeated. "Some of what was said was exaggerated." To Gwen Owens, it was important to note that the real hero of that night had been Margie Moore, who'd had the courage to go outside and seek help, armed with nothing more than a broom. And some of the other ladies there might have described things in a way that made it seem like they were the heroes of the story. But it was Miss Margie and Miss Margie Moore alone who'd been the hero, according to Gwen Owens. Gwen Owens wouldn't come out and say exactly what she meant. But, we noticed, whenever Gwen Owens would try and warn us about how some of the stories that had been told about that night might be exaggerations, she'd suddenly switch the topic back to Cora Fisher and ask us about what exactly Cora Fisher had said. And we tell her, she would nod, eyebrows raised, as if to say, "Well, that's exactly the sort of thing I'd expected Cora Fisher to say." Ed and I had gotten the point.
Oh my god, she was the sharp one.
Yeah, for sure.
I like how she was like doing her, "I'm not going to say who was a liar, but Cora Fisher's a damn liar." I think she brought it up again to make sure I got the point she was trying to say.
I mean, a number of people have said that, so...
Yeah.
Ed and I both left that interview convinced that Gwen Owens would have been an extremely credible witness at trial. Her story just made sense in a way that the testimony of some of the other church ladies never had. And she'd seen the shooter. She'd seen his glasses, and she'd seen how short he was and how nerdy looking. And she'd seen the long blonde hair. The man she described did not sound like Dennis Perry. And she would have testified that the composite image, the one that had convinced Dale Bundy that Dennis Perry was guilty, did not resemble the man who'd killed Harold and Thelma Swain. And Gwen Owens had also contradicted, at least implicitly, just about everything Cora Fisher had said. As Ed and I drove away from Gwen Owens' house, we wondered how things might have gone in Dennis Perry's trial had the defense called Gwen Owens to the stand.
Can you imagine her versus, like, Cora on the stand?
Yeah.
Like, and Cora wasn't even on the stand.
Yeah,
Cora was just, like,
the deposition.
Written words. But I think that Gwen Owens would have, like, torn her testimony up.
Yeah.
Cora Fisher was the only witness who had confidently ID'd Dennis Perry as the white man at Rising Daughter. But her story was also strange and erratic and had all kinds of asides that I could never really make sense of. But despite these possible gaps or questions about her testimony, the defense had never really put any evidence on to contradict it. But if Gwen Owens had been called to the stand, well, that would have painted a very different picture for the jury. But she hadn't been called. The defense hadn't known to call her. That's not because no one realized that Gwen Owens might be important to the case. In January of 2002, Dennis's then-wife, Karen Perry, wrote a letter to Dennis's attorneys, setting out a list of investigative leads in Dennis's case that she felt were important and that she wanted the defense team to investigate. The letter stated,
"Frankly, I don't understand why some of this has not already been done."
And in number 4 on her list below, Karen had listed the following tasks for Dennis's defense team.
"Interview with Gwen Owens and her daughter. I have been asking you time and time again about why we have not talked to her. She too saw a man with glasses. Gwen Owens did give a composite drawing.
Dennis Perry's defense attorneys never did do as Karen Perry had asked. And so they never learned that the problem with Gwen Owens as a witness was not that she'd seen a man with red hair and flaming eyes, like Dale Bundy had said, but that she'd seen a man that didn't match the man that Dale Bundy wanted to be guilty.
Hold the presses, guys, because the FabFitFun Fall Editor's Box is here. Now, you guys know I've talked about the FabFitFun box subscription. I love this service. I love the products. Just so you know what happens, the way it works is it's a seasonal subscription box. It's delivered 4 times a year and has full-size fashion, beauty, home, fitness, and wellness products. Those are all products that I love, and I also love not paying full price for them. These are not sample size. There's no samples of anything. These are full size products. They are expensive products, and they are a great gift to yourself, ladies, okay? It's nice to give gift to other people, but you might wanna give a gift to yourself too. And I began my day today. It's a beautiful fall day. It's been a long couple of weeks for me, and I began this morning by taking out one of the products. I've never used this before. It's a Glam Glow Oxygen Mask. I put it on my face. I told my husband, take the baby. I need some time to myself. I put that thing on my face. I did my nails while it did its magic, and I'm glowing. The FabFitFun boxes are an incredible value because they're only $49.99 a box, okay? But I'll give you an example. The total retail value of the fall box is actually over $275. You're getting $275 worth of full-size products, all kinds of great products, by the way. And you know, for me, because I love to try new products, but I don't want to pay full price for things. I also don't want to buy like full sizes of products I haven't used before. This is a perfect way to try things and be like, I like this thing. I'm going to keep buying this product now. You know, you get to try products full size at, I don't know, a fraction of their cost. It's amazing. So sign up today for FabFitFun and get your Fall Editor's Box. Now, it is in limited supply. These boxes always sell out. But believe me, you want to get in on this because you want to be glowing like I am right now. All you got to do is use our code UNDISCLOSED and you get $10 off your first box. So it's actually going to be $39.99 for almost $300 worth of products. Go to FabFitFun.com to sign up and start getting the box for a life well lived. Don't forget to use the promo code UNDISCLOSED because, once again, support our sponsors. They support us, so don't forget to use that code and get $10 off your first box. That's over $200 worth of stuff. I mean, actually nearly $300 for $39.99. Once again, go to FabFitFun.com and use our promo code UNDISCLOSED to get $10 off your first FabFitFun box.
Throughout the trial transcripts and case file notes, there were three places where there was a reference made to someone who'd been at the church that night that I didn't quite understand. There were 9 church ladies, 9 women who'd been at Rising Daughter, with Harold and Thelma Swain, plus little Leslie, Gwen's young daughter. But at 3 places in the whole file, it was almost as if there was a 10th name being referenced. Once by Cora Fisher, once by Benzilla Williams, and once by an unknown note taker on a page of notes tucked in the police file. At first, I didn't think all that much about it. Confusion in the case file over who was at the church that night wasn't unusual. Over the decades this case gone for now, new investigators repeatedly come in, looked at the file, and repeatedly gotten confused about who was in the church that night. For instance, one of the women had the full name of Melvin Louise Baker. She went by Louise, but sometimes she's referred to as Melvin Baker. So you can see notes and memos in the file reflecting where various people have looked at it and seen Melvin Baker listed there and gone, wait, what, who? Not realizing this was actually Louise Baker. So the fact that there were confusing descriptions of who was at the church that night wasn't unexpected. But these 3 stray references were different. For one thing, the 3 references were all to different names. For an example, it was like if you'd had on 3 separate documents references to 3 women. The first document lists the name Martha Smith, the second document lists the name Anna, and the third document has the name Miss Smith. So there's sort of an overlap there, but it's not at all clear these documents could be referring to the same person. So I dismissed these references as being just some kind of transcription error of some sort, but it kept nagging at me. Were these nicknames for a woman who was there? Were they typos? Were they the maiden names, maybe, of people at church? And then we got a new document. A new strip page of notes from the files that we'd recently obtained from the Camden County DA's office. With yet another reference to a woman's name I didn't recognize. And to continue with the earlier example, it was as if this name was something like, say, Miss Anna Smith. And seeing that name finally made it click with me, that these notes could all be talking about a single woman, a single witness, a single new witness. After some searching, I found the listing for a woman in Waverly that seemed to match. This is not her real name, but again, going on the previous example, think of it being something like Anne Marie Smith. It's not exactly the same name from the files, but it borrows bits and pieces from all of them, from all the references I hadn't understood before. And the listing I'd found had a phone number, so I gave it a call.
Hello?
At first, the woman on the other end didn't seem to know what I was talking about, which made sense to me, because, after all, this had to be some kind of misunderstanding. I just wanted to figure out how this woman's name, assuming it was her name, had gotten into the file in the first place.
A crime witness to who?
So all I know, so I'm looking into a crime from 1985 involving the murder of Harold and Thelma Swain.
Oh, uh-huh.
And I have a list of the women who were present that night, and one of them, at least on one of the police reports, is listed as...
Mm-hmm.
Would that be you?
Yes.
Was that you there that night?
Yes.
Oh, you were there?
Mm-hmm.
Okay,
I had not expected to suddenly be talking to an eyewitness from the crime. I mean, yes, I had called this woman because I'd wanted to find out she'd been a rising daughter that night, but I'd been expecting her to tell me that this was all a mistake, that she hadn't been there, so I was completely unprepared. Luckily for me, the woman on the other end of the line was caught less off guard than I had been.
Could you tell me about what happened that night and what you recall?
Ooh, it's been so long. I recall talking to him and sitting across from him, and somebody came in the front door of the church and asked for somebody, and one of the ladies came and got him and took him to the back, to the front door, and I heard, "No, I'm not going to talk to you," or something to that effect. And he said, "Yes, you are." And then I heard shot. And of course, I didn't know what shots were. So, but anyway, I looked back and I saw like him going down.
I had already known just about every word of the story she was telling me. But it was surreal to hear it being told to me by someone who had been there in person, who'd seen it happen. But I'd had no idea I'd been witnessing this case.
And his wife... it's coming back to me now. She was in front of me as the secretary of the church, because when she looked up and she said, "Oh, it's just a white man. They're always looking for something." And she went back to her secretarial work. And then we heard that noise, and when she heard the shots, she said, "Oh my God, Harold." And she ran to the door, and that person was waiting for her, right at the door.
I had 5 million questions for her, but I realized I needed to talk to her in person. So I asked if I could meet with her the next time I was down in Camden County, and she said, "Of course, just let me know when you're here." After I got off the phone with her, I immediately made a phone call to the Georgia Innocence Project to tell Claire Gilbert and Ned Kostikian what I just learned.
Hi, Susan?
Yep.
We're both here.
So, guess what?
Oh, no.
That doesn't sound very good.
Well, it's not bad. It's just like, what the fuck? There is another eyewitness to the shooting. A woman who saw the shooting was there that night and no officer ever spoke to.
What are you talking about?
I just spoke to her. She's like 80, but very sweet and seems very lucid. And she was there that night, saw the shooting, was never spoken to.
Well, okay. Explain.
So in the notes, like, there's a seating chart, the new notes we got. There's someone did it's a different set of, it's the church that night, who was sitting where, but doesn't match the other charts they've done other times. There's a woman on it that's not listed anywhere else, named, but there was no there that night. We have, like, all the statements, we have, like, the diagrams that they made, there was no, and I was trying to figure it out, and I'm like, well, screw it, I think she's still alive, I'm gonna call her, and thinking it'd be, like, nothing. She answers, and she's, like, happy to chat.
Wait. So how did you know the name?
Because in Laura Fisher's session, she mentioned someone named being there. And Susan and I both thought just her being like
her dead
and saying random names.
Holy shit.
A couple weeks later, while I was down in Waverly, I pulled up to a little house only a mile down the road from where Dennis Perry had once lived. I was there to meet with this new witness. It was early afternoon, so the cicadas were firing on all cylinders, at times drowning out even the cars that drove past us. She came out to meet me before I even got to her door, and we sat on her porch to talk. She is a tiny woman, but not frail. I knew from my research that she was in her 80s, but she doesn't look it. She's energetic and very expressive when she talks.
So, I do a podcast. It's like, do you know what a podcast is?
I've heard of it.
It's like an internet radio show.
Mm-hmm. She asked me not to use her real name on the podcast. It wasn't that she considered it to be a secret or anything that she'd been a rising daughter that night, but when she found out from me that her name wasn't really in the case file, at least as far as the public records went, she decided that she'd prefer to keep it that way.
What should I call you then?
Oh, whatever you want.
Any name?
Witness number 2, whatever, witness number 3, whatever, however you want to do it.
No made-up name?
Person that was the...
I'll make up a name for you.
Okay.
What should it be? You can choose.
Lavinia.
I'll do that.
So that's how I met Miss Lavinia, the 10th witness to the murders of Harold and Thelma Swain. An eyewitness to a murder that happened 33 years ago, and no one in the case since then has ever known about. Lavinia told me the same story she'd said on the phone, about how there'd been nothing particularly notable about the meeting itself that night at Rising Daughter, how they just had their missionary meeting, like usual. Lavinia recalls that things were winding down for the evening, and the group was taking care of some administrative matters.
And as I went to pay my dues, I shook hands with Harold over here, and I was telling him something about how to make it more interesting, so not to interfere with the secretary or anybody, we sat on the front seat and we chatted a little bit. Then he went back and got on his seat, and I went back and went back on the third seat.
As she talks, Lavinia uses her hands to illustrate what she's explaining, with one hand representing Harold and the other representing herself, and the little porch table we're sitting at becomes a map of Rising Daughter Baptist Church. She shows me how, after paying her dues, she'd started a conversation with Harold, but since Harold had been sitting in the first pew where Thelma and Margie Moore were trying to take care of church business, she and Harold had moved off to the side for a bit to talk, before returning to their seats in the center row. And that's when Benzola Williams had left the meeting, a few minutes early.
So she was counting the money, the lady that I was telling you about. She had to go get her daughter from work, whatever. She went to the door, because we kept hearing the door creaking. And I thought, oh, it's her husband. He drinks, and when he drinks, he's going to come and get her, protect her, take care of her. But anyway, I looked back, and I glimpsed a face, and I didn't pay any attention at that point.
The other woman at the meeting didn't pay much attention to it either.
This person said, oh, it's just somebody, some white man stopping by there, always stopping by for handouts at the church, which they did do. So she went to the door, and he said to her, I want to speak to that man over there. At this point, there was no other man in the church, and he was sitting there. So the usher, whoever she was, I can't remember her name, Van Zola or whatever, she came back, and she got him. And she took him to the door, and she started on out her way. And at that point, somebody said, oh, they're scuffling. And I thought maybe as men do, they're joking around. And then somebody else said, oh, they're fighting.
Then the gunshots began. But Miss Lavinia hadn't realized it at first. It wasn't until another woman identified it as gunfire that Lavinia really understood what was going on.
And then she said, oh, there's a guns are shooting. And of course, I'm used to a lot of noise, and I didn't know what a gun sounded like, really.
Lavinia remembers that she wasn't the only woman who'd been slow to react to the threat. Thelma Swain hadn't initially reacted to the scuffling either. At the time that Harold stepped into the vestibule to talk to the young man, Thelma had been busy in her duties as the Missionary Society's secretary, taking notes and counting the dues.
She was down like this with her writing, and she jumped up. Oh my God, Harold. And she ran to the door, and he was waiting for her at the door. And I said, the reason I said he was waiting for her, when I finally did look, when I ducked down and I looked under the seats, and I saw feet like this. And it stuck in my mind, because feet don't stand up like this normally. They either fall over or fall on. And they were standing straight up in between the vestibule door. And I said to myself, she's dead. You know, I thought to myself, she's dead simply because of the feet.
After a time that probably wasn't that long, but felt like forever, Lavinia had checked to make sure there was no one else around. And then she'd gotten up and gone for safety.
And I went all through the church, and I couldn't find nobody. And they were in the pastor's study, and I said, you can't stay in here. If there's a killer out here, he could kill all of us at one time. At that point, Margie went to look to see if he was, instead of going in the church, she went to the back door of the vestibule, past the study, back there, the dining room. And she opened the door, and instead of looking, she just kept running. And that's about the size of it.
In those seconds after the gun first went off, most of the other women had scattered, but Lavinia had still been trying to figure out what had happened and what was going on. While the other women ran, Lavinia had gone to the floor, hiding amid the pews and peering out under them to see if anyone was coming after her.
So you think you were alone in the sanctuary?
Yeah. Because when I finally found out that, you know, that it was real, everybody had gone, because like I said, I was used to a lot of noise and I didn't know what the noise. And when I didn't see nobody in there, I said, oh my God, it must have been something happening. There wasn't a soul in there but me.
Lavinia had been alone in the sanctuary, but before she left, she'd heard something out there in the vestibule that made her realize that one or both of the Swains might still be alive.
So, but when she ran to the door, I could hear groaning and groaning and dragging as if he was trying to get to her. And someone did tell her that I was going to go through to see, because I gotta go help him. I gotta go help him. He's out there. He's trying to help her. And someone said to me, you can't go out there. You don't want to see that. But he was trying to get to her. And that's why I said I heard moaning and groaning. And someone did tell me that they were hand to hand. He was trying to reach out.
They were.
Really?
Her hand was under his head. And he was reaching out to her.
Oh, my goodness.
After speaking to Lavinia, I had walked away from the interview, not sure how to process everything I just heard. But I also had a deeply lingering concern that somehow, maybe, I had just been catfished by an 80-year-old woman. And that either Lavinia was not as mentally sound as she'd seemed to me to be during our conversation, or else the story she told me had been some elaborate fabrication. And that would explain the reason that the police never talked to her, that the defense attorneys, prosecutors never found her. She hadn't really been there. In fact, Lavinia herself had suggested to me that something like that might have been tried before. That there were women who'd claimed to have been at the church that night, but weren't. She told me that at some point she had been interviewed by a police officer. And this interview happened because the police were afraid about someone doing just that.
This man, I guess, came to find out who I was and where I was and did I live here and make sure I was at the church, not riding the bandwagon. So that's all I know.
What do you mean riding the bandwagon?
Possibly after it happened, you know, somebody might have been saying, oh, well, I was there just to get in the news, not realizing how serious the situation. But you got people like that, you know, who want to be in the news.
Lavinia had been convincing, and she had the knowledge that a witness would have if they'd been in the church that night. But this was also a high-profile case, and Lavinia had sat through at least part of the trial. So she would have known a lot about the case, even if she hadn't been there. It was at least conceivable that's where she'd learned everything she'd told me. There were people I'd spoken to from Rising Daughter, and none of them had mentioned Lavinia to me. So, feeling somewhat paranoid, I'd called them to make sure that Lavinia had actually been a witness. And they all told me the same thing.
Do you know her well?
I do.
Was she at the church that night?
She was.
Okay. I spoke to her, and I was kind of shocked because she's not listed in the paperwork anywhere.
Okay, well, yeah, she was there.
But none of the people I'd asked that night had actually been there at the church when this happened. So later on, when I spoke to Vandora Baker, the first thing I asked her was about who all had been at the church that night. She started rattling names off, and I waited, kind of nervously, to see if Lavinia would be among them. So Vandora began counting off the names. Cora Fisher, Letty Frazier, Margie Moore, Vanzola Williams, and then Lavinia. And then she finished off listing the rest of the names. After Ed and I left Vandora's house, I have to say that even though I'd believed Lavinia's story by that point, it felt kind of relieving to know that another eyewitness had confirmed her presence.
Her memory was pretty good, honestly, like for... She kept saying she couldn't remember anything, but she remembered that night pretty well.
Yeah. She certainly said right away. So.
I know. I was like, is she going to say it? Oh my God. I left that interview and I was like, I don't want to be the person who gets hoaxed, gets catfished yes. by a witness who was never there. So I'm so relieved to have a lady that was actually, I felt pretty confident after everything, after hearing from Cynthia and everyone else, but like,
which means, in all, at least three other church witnesses have described Lavinia's presence of Rising Daughter that night. Vandora Baker, Vanzola Williams, and Cora Fisher all included her in their list of the women who were there in the church when Harold and Thelma were killed. Which means I'm pretty sure Lavinia was there. She was the 10th eyewitness in a case where, for 33 years, everyone had believed that there were only 9. I don't know how Lavinia got missed as a witness in this case, and I don't know how she ended up being written out of the official record, but she did get missed. No investigator I've spoken to has told me that they had any knowledge of her existence as a witness. When I asked them about it, neither Butch Kennedy, Joe Gregory, nor Dale Bundy had ever heard of her before. What seems to have happened is that Lavinia left Rising Daughter before any of the officers involved in actually investigating the case had arrived on the scene, so they never had a chance to speak to her. Lavinia told me about how when she and the other women had finally emerged from the church, her husband had been there, and he picked her up and taken her home. And at that time, there had only been one officer there. Lavinia hadn't known his name, but from her description, it must have been Officer Buddy Miller from the Woodbine Police Department. He was the first one there at the scene that night.
At some point, the police came, and he said, "I can't go in until I get reinforcements." By that time, my husband and my son had gotten there, because Margie, I don't know how she told him, but she told the whole neighborhood that we were all dead down there, and my husband said to the policeman, "Well, you wait for the reinforcements because my wife is in there and I'm going to get her." And at that point, I walked out, I think, or I met him at the door, whatever. I came out.
Did y'all come out the side door?
Yeah, I came out the side door. We couldn't go out the front.
Officer Miller was just trying to secure the scene, and by himself, he would not approach the church until more officers arrived as backup. But when Lavinia's husband and a few others from the community had arrived at the church to find out what was going on, they'd just gone on ahead into the church. That's when Lavinia's husband had found her. He'd gotten her into the car, and they'd just driven away. Before a second police officer had arrived on the scene, Lavinia was already safe at home. Still, even though most people involved in the case didn't know about her, my interview with Lavinia was not the first time she'd been asked about the Swain case. She had been talked to by a police officer, she's pretty sure, at least once before. And she's fairly certain that this happened in 1985, not long at all after the murders had happened.
A man came, as I said, and handed me his card, and which identified himself, and he just asked me who I, you know, identifying that I was who I was, and that I lived here, and that I did belong to the church, and he said, it's like he had a paper with questions, and he was checking it off, and he said, "Okay, that's it, that's all I needed to know," and he went away.
There's no way to know now who this officer was or what happened to his record of talking to her, but my best guess is that it simply never made its way into the Camden County Sheriff's Office file. In the very first days after the Swains were murdered, there were at least 5 GBI agents working on the case, plus just about every law enforcement officer and every law enforcement agency in all of Camden County. They'd all gotten involved in some way or another. And with all the paperwork in this case that's gone missing, it's not that hard to believe that this record of Lavinia was just another lost record that had fallen through the cracks. When I'm out somewhere working on a case, at the end of the day, I usually try to record a quick recap of everything I've done, just to help with piecing things together later, in case there's any gaps in my notes. That evening, while walking back to my hotel room in Brunswick, I tried to record a recap of everything I'd done that day so far, but all I could think about was Lavinia.
So, that was a day. I don't even know if I can process it right now. It feels like the truth of whatever happened to the Swains was frozen that moment in time on March 11th, 1985. And we've been moving further away from it ever since. There's not any sort of sense in this case of moving closer to the truth or uncovering it or making progress or, in any case, to suddenly have an unknown eyewitness to the murder who saw the killer come out of nowhere. For in a 33-year-old case to have that is impossibly low odds. And what it made me realize is that we could have a million eyewitnesses in this case. We could have a million people come out of the woodwork who were there, who saw it. And I don't think it would bring us closer to the truth.
I remember feeling weirdly down that night. I was glad to have found Lavinia, yes, but any excitement seemed outweighed by this immense frustration I was feeling, and I'm not sure I can completely explain now why. There was just so much that had been done wrong in the case over so many decades, and all I could focus on was, wow, Dennis Perry got screwed. And I have no idea how all these pieces can possibly be put together again. But I was wrong about Lavinia not getting us closer to the truth. Talking to Lavinia made me feel confident that eyewitness identifications were never going to be enough to solve this case. After 33 years and all the missteps in the investigation, it's just impossible. But what Lavinia shows us is where the investigation in Dennis Perry went wrong, and how the defense could have changed everything if they'd found her. First, Lavinia would have contradicted the only eyewitness to positively ID Dennis Perry. Because Lavinia's memory is clear that she was the last person in the sanctuary, not Cora Fisher. What Cora Fisher described in her deposition can't be reconciled with what Lavinia remembers.
And so Cora says that she fainted when this all happened, and she was still there in the room. You're making a face.
I don't know about that. I don't know. I can't remember. Cora, there's something that's not going on here.
Oh, no?
Yeah.
Lavinia asked me to turn the recorder off. It's not that she was reluctant to gossip necessarily, but she was reluctant to gossip while the recorder was running. And what she told me seemed very much in line with what Gwen Owens had also suggested to us, that Cora Fisher's story should maybe be taken with a grain of salt. And unlike Gwen Owens, Miss Lavinia had been at the trial. She'd not been recognized as an eyewitness, so she'd not been sequestered, and she heard Cora Fisher's story when the deposition was read out in court. Later on, while I was talking to her, Lavinia gave me a rather terse explanation of what her reaction had been to hearing Cora's testimony.
You were saying earlier that you heard Cora's story somewhere, and that you weren't sure about it?
Yeah. Because Cora, I'm thinking Cora was at the nursing home. How could she tell this story if she was at the nursing home? I think I heard somebody say that this is what reading out what she said. She read it out. I think that's the way it was.
I bet that was a trial.
Uh-huh. Well, that's why I'm saying
yeah.
Glenn.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And it didn't sound right to you?
No.
Lavinia doesn't think Cora Fisher meant any harm by any of it. She just doesn't think Cora Fisher got it right.
Like, she says at first the guy has black hair. And then at trial she says he has blonde hair.
She was a little bit flighty. I didn't want to say that because that's not nice to say.
And it's not just that Lavinia contradicts Cora Fisher's account of what happened that night. Lavinia also contradicts what Cora Fisher says she saw. Though Lavinia's account also gives the glimpse into eyewitness identifications in general can be tricky or sometimes unreliable. Because for the most part, Lavinia's memory seems sharp and clear, but there are parts of that night that she's never been completely sure how to make sense of. It's not so much that time and the passage of 33 years have faded her memory, but there are parts of what she recalls that she's always had a little trouble making sense of. For instance, what the man she saw looks like. Or rather, whether it was one man she saw or two. Because the first time she glimpsed the man in the vestibule, in that moment, when she first saw him for a split second, she hadn't actually realized it was a white man at all.
You see him once when he puts his head in the door, and you see him again when Thelma goes through the double doors.
I glimpsed, yeah, the doors were swinging and I looked back. And I just sort of glimpsed a person and I thought it was this woman's husband, so I didn't pay any attention. But the second time when I looked back, I saw a face. But the face was too fat and either too tall or too short to be the husband of the woman I was thinking it was. It definitely was not her husband.
Mm-hmm. But you assumed it was him before you saw it. So within your mind, you just kind of...
I thought it was him because he always did come to church. And he was fairly light-skinned, but this
was
too light.
I've heard he was kind of controlling. And he could be violent.
Yeah.
So he was... When you saw the man, what race did you think he was?
I thought he was her husband.
Okay.
So, Negro, black, whatever you want to call him.
Lavinia's confusion kind of makes sense to me, though. That first glimpse she got of the man in the vestibule, well, she hadn't really been paying attention. She'd already known who was there in the vestibule, or at least she thought she had. It was Vanzola's husband, who'd come to check up on his wife. And so, even though everyone else saw a white man with blonde hair look in, when Lavinia had briefly glimpsed back, she'd seen what she'd expected to see. Vanzola's husband. Which she knows doesn't fit. She knows it doesn't make sense. But it's also what she recalls seeing in that moment. But the second time Lavinia saw the man in the vestibule, she could clearly see it was a white man. And she could clearly see that it was not Vanzola's husband. What she remembers is the blonde hair and a round face. A fat face, as she described it. And when I showed her the individual composites that were prepared by the other ladies, the three composites that, to me, that looked like characters of a slightly effeminate California surfer dude, she thought that there could be some resemblance there with the man she'd seen that night.
I'll show you one more. How's that look?
Oh, my. Ooh. It's possible. It's possible. Again, this is a close-up, and I was far away, but it's possible, the hair, except it would have been here like that, or the wind might have blown it, so, but it was blonde. It might have been blown across his face.
When you say, so you were just gesturing, were you saying like bang-like?
Yeah, like that.
But one face she does not recognize at all is the face of the man who was convicted of this crime.
No one. They never asked you to identify him? I'm sorry, why wouldn't they have gotten a photo?
I can't. If they did, I just don't remember identifying him positively as being, you know, there. Like I said, it's if it were so, it would have been younger and that person that I edited. I can't remember Dennis Perry.
Lavinia thinks Dennis Perry is guilty because he was the guy that got convicted. She doesn't have any doubts about that. He was convicted and he did it. But she also clearly struggles to make sense of why and how Dennis Perry is guilty, because although she is not certain if she saw one man or two different men, she is sure that none of the faces she saw that night could be Dennis Perry's. Her way of explaining all this seems to be a belief that there had in fact been three men there that night, one of whom she hadn't seen at all.
It's possible, like I said, there was a third person, it's possible, that left.
But Lavinia does not believe that the white man she saw that night, the one standing behind the double doors when Thelma pushed through them, could have been Dennis Perry. Because Lavinia thinks she knows who that man is.
I don't want to make unfair, because I could be 5% wrong, but no more than that.
I can say with a lot of confidence that Lavinia's belief about who she may have seen that night is not correct. For a variety of reasons, I think she must have been mistaken. That man did live in northern Camden County back at the time this all happened, and he had once been briefly considered to be a suspect in the case, but I don't think it's possible that Lavinia could be correct about who she thinks she saw. But her fear about whether this man really did it is genuine and understandable. She's both afraid that it may be him and afraid of unfairly accusing someone when she can't be completely sure. To me, the most notable fact about Lavinia's belief about who she saw is not the man's actual identity, but the fact that this man looked nothing at all like Dennis Perry. Lavinia simply would not have identified Dennis Perry as the man she'd seen in the vestibule when Thelma pushed through the double doors. The jury never heard from Lavinia, though, and they never heard from Gwen Owens either. Instead, they only heard from the eyewitnesses who agreed with Dale Bundy's theory of the case. And when a jury only hears from two eyewitnesses who identify a defendant, and not from the two that didn't identify him? Well, that's one way of making sure that the truth is harder to obtain.
Thank you.
that's all for episode 11 of Undisclosed, The State versus Dennis Perry. Thanks for sticking with us through the mid-season break, and there's no addendum this week, but we'll be back next Monday with episode 12. Methil Telham is our executive producer, and our logo is designed by Paluki. Our theme music is by Ramiro Marquez and Patrick Cortez. Audio production is done by Rebecca Lavoie of Partners in Crime Media and the host of the Crying Writers On podcast. To find transcripts of episodes, timelines of key events, case-related materials, and witness charts, go to our website at undisclosed-podcast.com. And transcripts of these episodes are prepared by our wonderful transcribing team of Britta Bliss, Erica Fladell, Don Locus, and Skylar Park. Huge thanks goes to those guys. Without them, you'd not have the transcripts. And thanks so much to our sponsors for making it possible for us to come back week after week. And don't forget to follow us online. On all social media, our handle is at UndisclosedPod. That's Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter. And if any of our listeners out there have information on Dennis Perry's case that you'd like to share, we'd love to hear from you. You can reach us at UndisclosedPodcast@gmail.com or leave us a message at 410-205-5563. That's all for this week, and thanks so much for listening.